You're listening to the Whale Scout Podcast with your host, Whitney Negebauer.
Welcome to the Whale Scout Podcast, everyone. My name is Whitney Negebauer, and I'm the Executive Director of Whale Scout. Today is January 24th, 2019, and we've got a really great show coming up. We're going to be talking with Amy Carey of Sound Action. And you know, she's been working for a long time on drawing connections between endangered orcas in Puget Sound and some of the foundational habitats that they rely on and some of the foods and their food that they also depend on. But first, I want to share with you a little bit of news, and we'll talk about this with Amy later on, but some of the Orca Task Force's recommendations have now been transferred and morphed into bills in Olympia. So I suggest everyone try to do their best and follow what's going on. That's been made a lot easier with the help of members of the Salish Sea, the ecosystem and advocates group. And what's happening there is that they're working to just about every week send an update out to their email list about what's going on in Olympia and how they can plug in and help. Because things change all the time without very much notice. And so it can be quite laborious to try and keep up. And so thankfully, they are doing a great job of doing that for us. One thing that everyone can do right now is to contact their representatives. There's a link in this podcast show notes on how to do that, how to look up who your representatives are and how to email them. So please do that now and just make sure to tell them how you feel about the orca recovery bills that were just introduced this week. Another thing that's a little more hands-on is Whale Scout will be hosting a number of Help and Out events this spring and even into summer. Our next one is on February 9th, and that will be at Terminal 105, which is right on the Duwamish in Seattle. And basically, that site used to be a parking lot, and it was turned into a park. And the parking lot was removed, and now we're working with a group called Earth Core to help reinstall some native vegetation, which will help in a number of ways, reducing toxins, lowering temperatures in the river, and providing better habitat for salmon. So we have a sign-up sheet on our website, whalescout.org. I encourage you to join that one. Let's see. The next one is March 2nd. It's sort of an informal thing, but it's really, really fun. We've been connected with the Skagit Fisheries Enhancement Group and attending their nursery where they have their native plants that need to grow up a little bit before they can put them at restoration sites. And they have this really cool connection and opportunity in having a native plant nursery in order to buy smaller, often bare root plants at a much cheaper price, and then having volunteers like us come and help put them in pots. So it's all part of this process and operation that we've been working on into restoring habitat for salmon and restoring riparian zones or the vegetation around rivers and streams. It's just like one step prior to us actually working on this site. The Skagit Fisheries Enhancement Group also received some funding from Orca funds, basically, to do this work. So it was really drawing the connection between riparian zones, salmon, and orcas. So it's really, really cool. So that will be on March 2nd. And you can look on our Facebook page or on the Skagit Fisheries Enhancement Group's website, and you can sign up through that group. It's really fun. It's up in Mount Vernon. Let's see here. After that, we are in March hosting our second Sunday sightings program. We just began it in the fall, and now we're picking it up after some of the winter months are over. And there'll be sites all over the region, and we'll let you know where those are. We just added a number of new volunteers, and so we're working to plug everyone in and spread everyone out so we can have the best coverage of Puget Sound that's possible. After that, we will be meeting at Idlewood Park in Redmond to do a Help and Out event there, and that will be on March 30th. So keep those in mind. Sign up on our website to make sure that there's enough room for you, and You'll feel great, I promise, getting outside and planting some trees and kicking butt with the invasive plants. It's going to be a lot of fun. So now, without further ado, I'd like to introduce our guest on the podcast today, Amy Carey. We are back here on the Whale Scout podcast, and today we're joined by Amy Carey of Sound Action. Amy, how are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Good.
Glad to be here.
Excellent. We're so happy to be talking with you. I've actually known you for quite a long time, and you've not ever been a guest on our podcast. So I'm really excited to chat with you today and share a lot of your work with Whale Scout and our listeners. So,
well,
yeah,
I'm super glad to be here because I am a big Whale Scout and all the work that you do fan. I'm a little fangirl of Whale Scout. So I'm really glad to be here to talk to you about whales.
Yeah. And so we're going to talk a little bit about the history of Sound Action. You guys were actually born as Preserve Our Islands that work to save some property over on Maury Island. Can you give us a little snapshot of what that was like?
Yeah, it was a really long and gratefully really successful battle and fight for nearshore habitat that was located on Maury Island, which is just off of Vashon and Maury, are kind of the same mass of land that's in the sort of south to central Puget Sound region. And the prior sort of the basis of Sound Action's organization, we used to be called Preserve Our Islands, and we were born sort of as a rising up citizens activist grassroots organization to fight back. Oh gosh, it was probably, it feels like an eternity ago now, 15 or so years ago, when a internationally owned huge mining company put forward this proposal to create what would have been the biggest gravel mine like in the country on the shoreline of Puget Sound, in an area where there's a lot of really intact nearshore habitat, and particularly too where the orcas were regularly traveling. And so Preserve Our Islands kind of rose up to push back on that and really dove into kind of a citizen scientist, activist, legal, watchdog, oversight, regulatory group, and ultimately won that fight through legal challenges and some different strategies that put into place. And because of that, that whole shoreline area now is protected. We regularly see, you know, the whales using that area, and it was huge for juvenile salmon and forage fish. And when we won that fight, we had a really big party, which is very important. And then we realized that the same thing that we were seeing there, that these proposals that would just be devastating to habitat were given a green light kind of at every turn from permitting agencies, whether that was at the federal level, the state level, the local level. And so kind of recognizing all we had learned and the skill set we had gained and the legal strategies we knew how to do and the partnerships throughout the state, we really realized there was a high value to carry that forward for all of Puget Sound and the Salish Sea. And so in sort of the 2013 to 2014 timeframe, we stepped forward then as Sound Action and very carefully selected the name of to reflect the idea of taking action, not just a sort of feel-good exercises. And so we stepped forward as Sound Action and started doing the work that we do now, which is very specifically watchdogging one of the state permits. That's a cornerstone that all nearshore development requires this permit to move forward. And so we stepped forward with kind of that background and that basis to move forward to hopefully carry what we knew how to do throughout the whole Salish Sea.
And I think one of the things that was really cool about the story and about the mission of Sound Action is that you're always connecting killer whales to these habitat projects that I think sometimes get overlooked in the fight to save our endangered killer whales. I mean, even the some of the court cases with the Maury Island now park had to do with the impacts directly to orcas. So I just think, you know, and now continuing that focus is you're kind of ahead of your time. I think nowadays we're seeing more of the connection of the total ecosystem and the habitat for the food that killer whales eat. But that's just always been something that's really impressed me.
Yeah, it is. It was interesting going through that sort of the process and the work experience with Preserver Islands. And I started out with Preserver Islands as just a volunteer, right? Like a citizen, activist, volunteer, naturalist, and ultimately became sort of president of the organization and then the executive director and carrying it forward. And we did, from the very onset of this, we were focusing on the baseline of nearshore habitat and how that carries all the way up, of course, to orcas. And in that, the challenges with the Maury Island fight, and it really informed kind of next steps and strategies, I believe we were the first organization to take a legal challenge to protect orcas under the Endangered Species Act, because they were just, you know, listed sort of around some of that time period. And we had a federal court case that we won, which that's not very common to win federal court cases, but there was a specific focus on the southern resident orcas. But again, the sort of trickle down of, we were talking in those cases about the baseline of nearshore habitat, whether that was eelgrass and kelp, forage fish, to salmon, to orcas, and how that goes, of course, from sort of bottom to top and back again. And that really has been at the core of the work that we do and a strong part of our mission and how we take the actions that we take and why we take the actions that we take.
And one of the things that you have been working on over this last year is you were selected to participate in the prey availability working group with the Orca Task Force.
Yeah, we have. And I would sort of, just as a little background to that too, so when we stepped forward to do our regional work, we focused very specifically on a state environmental law called the Hydraulic Code, and I wish they would name it anything but that, because it doesn't necessarily reflect sort of like an environmental bent to it, and it's kind of confusing what it means. But so we, for the past, 4 years or 5 years, have been focused specifically on watchdogging that really critical state environmental law. Anything that's a nearshore, and frankly freshwater too, but our focus is marine because that's more of our expertise. If it's a marine shoreline project, it requires this permit that's called an HPA under the Hydraulic Code. So we review every single one of those permits. And if they don't do what they're supposed to do, if they don't follow the regulations or apply the laws appropriately, or they lead to habitat loss, we'll actually file legal appeals, whether that's sometimes there's an administrative process, and sometimes that means we end up in what's basically a court process. And so that gives us a volume of information that I think is really unique, because even the department, those permits are under the Department of Fish and Wildlife. They don't even necessarily do their own internal audits. And so we're the ones, we've probably reviewed 2,500 of those permits, marine permits, in the past several years. And so we really have this kind of unique knowledge of what happens on each one of those, and are they protecting habitat, and where are their gaps? And these are permits that are really geared towards the protection of fish life, and you know, whether that's forage fish or salmon or some different species in there. And so, because of that work and the role that we play, we were appointed then to the prey availability work group, supporting the task force, the Orca Recovery Task Force. And the key component of what the work group, the prey availability work group, was really assigned was to come up with bold, we use that word a lot, but it's really important right now when we're talking about orcas, but to come up with bold, meaningful, and strategic actions and recommendations that would be really critical for increasing the availability of Chinook populations for the southern resident orcas. And we spent countless hundreds of hours traveling across the state with all the rest of the members of that group to come up with what, through a frustrating process and a process that was sometimes feeling a little iffy of whether it was going to be meaningful, but ultimately coming up with some recommendations that were adopted to really move the dial on increasing salmon populations and availability for the whales.
And so you guys have been focused on HPA permits and working to try to make some changes in how these are applied and how they are received and processed. So do you think that this ORCA task force is going to truly move the dial on addressing your concerns? Do you think it's the key to moving forward and making this better for everyone?
Well, I think right now we're at a really critical point and, frankly, a test for are we moving the dial forward? Because what came out of some of that process was strong recommendations, even though they might have been slightly imperfect, but recommendations that really recognize when we're talking about increasing prey and increasing Chinook populations, that habitat protection is a foundation of this work. And even if we were doing every other thing that we know, whether it's restoration or, you know, all the range of actions, if we don't have this cornerstone of habitat protection, we lose. It really is the baseline for it. And so I think what we've seen right now there's just been some legislative actions as a result of the recommendations that were put forward both to the task force that were then adopted and that the governor has picked up that are very keyed in on some significant changes to make immediately that will give us some much stronger tools and pathways for protecting this nearshore habitat, the preservation through the application of the hydraulic code. So we're hopeful, and we're, along with some other environmental partners that are as part of the Environmental Priorities Coalition, we've all adopted an ORCA recovery package as a priority legislation this year. But these bills that have just been released that are governor request bills, which gives them a little more oomph behind them, are really significant. So I'm right now very hopeful that we are on a verge of making some really meaningful changes and creating some new tools in habitat protection through some changes to the hydraulic code.
Can you explain a little bit more about the changes that you're hoping to see? And do you have any idea, like, how much shoreline habitat could be protected? You know, any metrics on fish or eelgrass that would be benefited if these pieces of legislation were passed?
Yeah. So one of the largest gaps, and there's many gaps, right? That's just the reality with environmental laws. They're not perfect. But the interesting thing about the hydraulic code, and it's a big part of why we focused on it too, is as it's written, it is intended to be a very strong tool. Its whole intent and the language behind it is the protection of fish life. And when they say that, they'll define it as, you know, whether it's the habitat supporting fish, everything from the smallest sort of, you know, benthic habitats through vegetation or water, you know, sedimentation issues and things like that. So it's a very, very strong tool if applied appropriately. And one of the largest gaps that we recognized early on and have been working to change for quite some time was related to shoreline armory, which the science is very clear. We know that shoreline armoring is one of the most devastating and detrimental impacts to nearshore habitat. And across multiple layers of that habitat, it will immediately displace and remove forage fish spawning habitat, the surf smelts and the sand lamps that are primary food source for juvenile salmonids and even, you know, salmon as they get older. But it's not even just as simple as the forage fish habitat, because what we know, again, from the scientific studies is that this hard shoreline armoring interrupts every major process of a natural functioning shoreline. And so you lose the forage fish spawning habitat. You have changes to the sedimentation on the beaches, which leads to changes that might eliminate vegetation even a little bit farther out. You know, all of these things add up to a vast loss of habitat for the support of truly the whole food web. And, you know, we kind of have a saying sometimes at Sound Action, we'll say little fish plus big fish equals orca. And so if you're not supporting that baseline of a nearshore habitat, which has not been happening for decades now because of some of these regulatory gaps, it's no surprise that we have Chinook populations or just general salmon populations and forage fish populations that are in huge decline. And then in turn, southern residents that are starving to death because they don't have the food sources that they need. So in particular, there's been a large permitting gap with shoreline armoring or bulkheads under the hydraulic code. And one of the biggest chunks of that is that there's basically, to sort of simplify it a little bit, there's basically a legal gap that allows and even kind of promotes a fast-track approval for single-family bulkheads under the hydraulic code. And so a vast majority of those armoring applications are not really given a full and strong review. For example, they're not given a requirement to have what we'll call a needs analysis. Like, is there really an issue that needs addressed? Is there erosion? What are the different ways to address that? And what's sort of a least impacting use, meaning what's the smallest footprint or touch that you could take in addressing an issue? So right now, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, who oversees the hydraulic code, doesn't have the strongest tools to really dig into that very harmful impact to really appropriately regulate it. And what has come out of both our work with the prey availability work group to the task force recommendation to the governor and now recently released as bill proposals as legislation that's now under consideration would close that gap so that every shoreline armoring permit would have to go through a reasonable but still rigorous environmental review to make sure that habitat loss was being prevented during the permitting of single-family bulkheads, which is, you know, closing that gap is truly a huge move forward in protecting nearshore and shoreline habitat for, again, forage fish, for vegetation, for benthic habitat, for juvenile salmonids, and, of course, then for orcas.
You did a really good job explaining the connection and the food web, which reminded me of a short documentary film that you were featured in. I believe it was called Shorelines of Stone. Is that correct?
Yeah.
That's something that I think every orca lover needs to watch. And I'll include it in the show notes here so people can be connected. It was just fantastic.
It was, and we were really glad to have the opportunity to sort of remind folks of that, that when we're looking at these, you know, awesome and iconic creatures of the Southern Residents, and truly the reason I'm involved in environmental work in the Salish Sea and Puget Sound is because of orcas. I will often tell the story of the first time, about 20 years ago, I think. And I live in an area on Vashon Island where we're really lucky to have the whales when they come through this area. Kind of this time of year, there's some spots where they travel very close to the shoreline. And the first time I saw an orca in the wild, and I grew up in the Midwest, it was Day One, who, you know, he's passed now, but for folks who might remember seeing him, his dorsal fin was, like, just remarkable. And the first time I saw orcas, period, was Day One, and he was about 10 feet off the beach. And I remember stepping back because he was so awesome and remarkable. And I share that with people sometimes because it's that reminder of really in that moment, and that touchstone, I think those are where things change for people too. And this is why I really am such an admirer of Whale Scout, right? You give those people that opportunity. I had that experience with him, and from that day forward, there was a commitment and a knowledge of we need to do whatever we can to be protecting and helping the Southern Resident Orcas. And so, but again, once you have that awareness of the whales, and then you're looking at the bigger picture, if you care about whales, you have to care about forage fish. And even, frankly, the things smaller than the forage fish, the benthic habitats that are kind of the tiny microscopic things. But that really is the whole picture that we all need to be focusing on, I believe, if we're going to be successful at saving the Southern Residents.
Yeah, those benthic habitats don't have the sweet dorsal fins like J1 had.
No, they don't. They don't. But if J1 or his next of kin and everybody else, it really is something. I just think it is that thing of if you see the whales and you have the experience with them, and sometimes that's even just now, frankly, through the power of social media and things. But if you care about the Southern Residents, you have to care about what's happening in the sand, basically.
Yeah. Another thing I should share with our audience is that for folks living over on Vashon Mori Island, you guys have a pod blast system that sends out really helpful texts of where to go and when to hopefully intersect with our resident orcas. And you give land-based positions, which I think is really helpful for just about everyone.
Yeah,
so that's a really, and was that the story you were telling me about was at the lighthouse, Point Robinson, down on Maury Island?
Point Robinson, yeah, it's pretty awesome. And that is where I first saw J1. And so the Pod Blast, you know, even though we're now a regional group, I mean, we work from the border of Canada all the way to the depths of the southern inlets of Puget Sound. But Pod Blast was kind of a throwback to when we were a little bit more local, and it really was that how are you getting people onto the beach to interact with the whales and see the whales and then recognize sort of the bigger job that we all have. And so it's kind of just still a throwback that we do because I you know, I do spend a lot of my time through the late fall and winter monitoring the whales when they're down in this area, as do you. And I love that. I feel like there's different networks that I often say we sort of have these relay batons where we hand off like, oh, here you go. Now they're back to you and do some work on that. But yeah, the Pod Blast is a lot of fun because it is, again, helping people at least have that interaction and seeing the whales and knowing then they have to pay attention to what's below their feet when they're standing on the beach. And it's really, we had a really great experience. It was miserable weather, but just a few days ago, I think last week in Cape Cod came through, and there were probably 200 people on the beach, and some of them were a group of elementary students that we had gone to make a presentation on and signed them all up for Pod Blast. So that's really, and it's fun. It's not really, our focus is not necessarily on educational work, but sometimes we have those little touches, and it's quite an amazing experience to see people seeing whales for the first time.
Yeah, I love the community feel when everyone's out there and there's screams and applause, and it's just a really cool experience.
It is, and that's why I think, too, I really love that there's a connection between some different groups that do this, I think collaboratively, too, from some of the North Sound to the Middle South Sound, and so that we're all kind of sharing in that collectively as well.
Yeah. So for people who are listening and they want to take action right now, what are your suggestions?
So I would say that our biggest action right now, I mean, of course, we always love if people want to sign up for our email, going to soundaction.org and sign up for our kind of email list so you can keep in touch with what we're doing. But I think our more action alert sort of focuses right now are related to this legislation that has just dropped. That has just been, you know, put forward. And so there is a House Bill 1579, and then there's a Senate Bill 5580 that are similar, slightly different titles, but basically they carry both the changes that we're hoping to make related to shoreline armoring, and a second layer, too, that I should touch on that the Department of Fish and Wildlife currently has very limited tools for what we would call basically enforcement, that if they find somebody who's just disregarding the law or destroying habitat, they don't currently have the same tools that other agencies might, like stop work orders, to be able to just step in and say, stop, you're just killing habitat, stop right now. Both of those bills include both the really critical stuff with shoreline armoring to close that gap so that armoring, again, one of the highest impact development issues, gets a really strong review. And then also sort of as a partnership to that gives the Department of Fish and Wildlife the authority for some really enhanced kind of civil authority, meaning they can do stop work orders or issue fines if somebody's blatantly disregarding the law. So both of those bills are now on the table officially. The House bill, which is 1579, has a hearing on Tuesday, the 29th. That's also the Environmental Lobby Day, which is where, you know, quite a few activists will come together under the umbrella of the Environmental Priorities Coalition and, you know, learn some different things about how to do kind of some outreach to their own legislators. But there's also a hearing that day at 10 a.m. on the 29th in Olympia. So people could certainly, if they're in the area, go to that hearing, sign in, participate in the legislative process right now. Is very critical. And it doesn't have to be just on that day. It can be that day, but it can also be outreach to wherever somebody's, whatever district they're in, and their elected officials to let them know their support of that legislation and the bills. Those are really critical things for people. Right now, there's a really unique opportunity for people to use their voice in a meaningful way. And so that's really on the, you know, on a what other folks can do right now while we're in there in the trenches reviewing every permit and taking action. Getting involved in this legislative process is huge right now.
For sure. You know, there's a number of bills that that just dropped. And what I did was I, you know, found the email addresses for my, you know, legislative senators and representatives.
Yep.
Just was like, all right, this is what I'd like to see, you know,
sure.
And just made the list. And I think, you know, it'll be good to follow these bills throughout the process, see how things change over time, and then just keep your opinion, you know, known to your representatives and make sure that
Absolutely.
They're aware of what's going on and what you want to see.
Yeah, using your voice is a powerful thing, and I know that sometimes it might seem like it's sort of futile with, you know, just these different processes and, you know, all of the different systems there, but having gone through quite a few different legislative sessions and running different bills and kind of, you know, working that system, I have to say, people should not be cynical about that. Their voices mean a lot, and using them is a powerful thing.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. Is there anything else that you'd like to touch on that we haven't already talked about?
Well, no. I mean, I just want to say again how much I appreciate the work that you all do, and how, you know, I think when we look at the time where we are right now, I mean, this is a very real chance that orcas go extinct on our watch unless we all come together and do something. And those are hard choices and bold choices and sometimes uncomfortable choices or decisions that we make together. But really, that time is now, and I think we just have such a strong opportunity to be making some of the changes that we need right now. Of course, it's for the orcas, but the reminder too that it is everything on down. We have, you know, salmon that are going extinct. We have forage populations disappearing, and Puget Sound itself on the brink of collapse. So we are at a critical time right now to sort of turn these tides and turn this around. And I think that our only real chance to do this comes down to people power and people really stepping up to do some of the hard work and make sure that the people that we've either elected or the agencies that are put in place to sort of be on these front lines are doing their job.
Well, I want to thank you for chatting with us today and for being really persistent about drawing attention to our, you know, foundational habitats in the marine environment and making the connection to orcas and just keeping on fighting for that. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And I'm sure we'll all be talking more about all this stuff in the future, too.
Yes, we'd love to chat with
all
you
right.
Again.
Okay.
Thank
Sounds
you.
Good.
Thanks, everyone, for listening today. If you are interested in learning more about the legislative process and having updates from Olympia, I suggest you follow the Facebook group Salish Sea. So Salish and then SEA, that's Ecosystem Advocates. Go up there and sign up for updates, and that will be the best way, I think, to follow what's happening. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast today, go up to the Whale Scout website or iTunes, just type in the Whale Scout podcast, and you can have all of these shows sent directly to your phone by signing up for our podcast. And you can listen to it in the car, when you're working out, wherever you'd like. And we appreciate your subscription. So thank you very much. Namaste.
Thank you for listening to the Whale Scout podcast. Your voluntary donation goes toward the recovery of whale species and enhanced whale watching opportunities in the Pacific Northwest. Please visit www.whalescout.org for more information.
Bah, le type est trop bien démodé, aussi mal coiffé qu'écrasé, j'entretiens ma gueule négligée. J'esquive conseils préjugés.